Our thanks to Dr. David Kaye, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector, for his comments today. I'm Dr. Michael Nach, Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Dr. Kaye, as you see, we have a large number of questions, so let's begin. Obviously, we can't touch on many of the subjects that have been raised, but some of them cluster into a few categories, and the first has to do with kind of lessons learned from your experience and also some factual questions about Iraq. So let me start with a few of those. Was there any fundamental difference between your conclusions on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and the, what this questioner calls the independent conclusions by Hans Blix, David Albright, and Mohammed El-Baradei? Any fundamental differences between your conclusions and theirs?
You know, since Bill Clinton is in town, I probably should take the defense. It depends on what you mean by fundamental. there were significant differences. Let me describe it in the positive sense. Iraq was clearly, in my view, and I think we produced the evidence, in violation of UN Resolution 1441. There were activities it carried out that were prohibited, that they did not report to the UN inspectors. There were activities and equipment that they kept away from the inspectors, and the inspectors didn't conclude. With regard to the conclusion, and maybe this is what the questioner needs by fundamental, did Iraq have, at the time of the war, large stockpiles of chemical biological agents or a nuclear program at the advanced stage? I think no. Dr. Blix and I are in agreement on that.
Do you believe weapons inspectors were a vital source of intelligence to the British and the United States? And was the same intelligence provided to the United Nations?
And this refers to the period between 1991 and 1998 where inspectors were on the ground. And let me describe the process to answer that question. No one, and this is amazing, I can tell you exactly where I was when the event occurred. I was in China when the Gulf War broke out, doing a course for the Chinese government on evaluation in the nuclear power industry, because they had just laid two layers of concrete without any rebar, and the workers didn't tell them about that until they were into the third layer, and that was an expensive lesson to learn. I finished that up and thought I deserved something, so I went off by myself to Telluride to go skiing. Now, Telluride is the best place in the world to watch a war in the Middle East, because you wake up in the morning to ski and you get the evening report, you ski all day, you come back and you get the morning report. And I had not a clue. The war ended that I was going to be involved at all. I got back to Vienna, Austria, and discovered that, and you know, the lack of post-war planning is not unique to this administration. Maybe it's unique to the Bush family, but it's not unique to this administration. No one had thought about, what do we do with the Iraq? We're not going to Baghdad. Iraq had chemical biological missiles. What do we do? And so in 24-hour period, they wrote a resolution that said the UN should go in, and I mean, it's the best marching orders I ever had. We were to destroy, remove, or render harmless. I mean, that should have been on my playpen, because as my parents will tell you, I spent at least 12 years doing that. But we went off, and you know, at least in the nuke area, we've been conducting periodic inspections of Iraq, so we knew a little bit about it. But Iraq, as everyone needs to be reminded, is a huge country, size of California. Baghdad is the size of LA. We needed technical intelligence, and we needed any other intelligence anyone had. And we put out a request to all the UN governments, tell us what you know about the Iraq weapons program. Initially, the only one to respond, only two, were the US and the UK. Later, some others came in. And so we took this information. Now, in the process, and if you haven't worked in intelligence, with intelligence information, let me tell you, it's almost all ambiguous, or as a friend of mine likes to say, half of it's right, half of it's wrong, we just can't tell you which half is which. And so you would get information, you'd go out on the ground, you'd seek to examine it, and sometimes it'd pan out and sometimes it's not. You convey that information back to the people who provided you the intelligence so that the next go around they can improve what they tell you. It's a cycle, and if you don't do that every time you're going out with someone who hasn't improved their access. So there was a constant interchange. Was it supplied to the UN? Not broadly, because remember, Iraq was a member of the UN. And so what you were providing is you provided the people who provided you the intelligence a feedback loop. It was done, it was vital. And let me tell you, one reason we got to where we were in 2003 is because when you lost on-site inspection in 1998, you had to fall back on satellite photography, who still doesn't do anything for you if you're inside a building, as telling you what's going on, or defectors who told us the stories they thought we wanted to hear, and we were dumb enough to want to hear them.
Following up on the issue of the United Nations role, do you think that the United Nations should have the lead role in ongoing weapons monitoring, or should it be the United States that has this role, or some other party? And or does it depend on which country is involved, Iraq versus other rogue regimes?
Well, with regard to Iraq, where the U.S. has had the lead responsibility since the war, it's absolutely essential to multilateralize this and transfer this back to other organizations. The problem with saying the U.N., as Michael knows, in the biological weapons area, there's not a U.N. organization that can take that up, and we need to create or to expand the capabilities of an existing one to do it. The responsibility for the continued monitoring in Iraq. And look, Iraq is a country that is going to require continuing monitoring. They have the secrets. They know how to do it. And so the world and the region has an interest in that. It has got to be an international one, not the U.S. I think there are circumstances in which it doesn't have to be the U.N. The best example I can think of was the arrangement between Brazil and Argentina. When they both decided to back away from their nuclear program, they both had problems with the non-proliferation regime, and for the initial period, they decided that they would conduct the inspections of each other. And that's, you know, that's suitable. I don't think there's a reason to hang up on ideology or religion to say it's always got to be the UN, but it is usually better if it's not a single state.
Let me remind the radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our speaker today is Dr. David Kay, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector, who is discussing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and new threats to national security. One questioner asked the following, David. Even with your call for an overhaul of the intelligence services, do you think your report or any other report justified the United States deciding on a preemptive strike in Iraq?
I guess if I understand the question. The question is, was there justification for a preemptive strike? I have to answer, and it's a question I ask myself almost every day, is because the equation changes almost every day. I think today we're up to 853 Americans who have been lost since the war began, and you can't face that without asking yourself, was it worth it? I think Saddam was a threat to his neighbors, a threat to the region. I think Saddam on his own wouldn't have changed. I think Saddam and Iraq was actually a more dangerous place than we recognized. It had become a criminal society where everyone and everything was for sale. In a market, and we do have a market out there in which terrorists and others are trying to obtain weapons technology related to chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Eventually, a willing buyer or willing seller would have come together in Iraq, and we probably wouldn't have known about it until after the fact. And I guess there's another sense, and this is the hardest to convey. I had often to go out to Hilla, where the first mass grave was found. You'd go out there last year, roughly at this time of the year and in July, a temperature of 140 degrees Fahrenheit. You'd see Iraqi families out there digging with their hands without any implements, trying to find a piece of cloth, an identity paper, something that would tell them their son, their daughter, their husband, wife, had been killed by Saddam. My concern is that 10 years from now, we'll have going through Cal Berkeley, probably through your school, Michael, a very smart Iraqi political scientist who will write his dissertation, which will essentially say, the Americans in the West only cared about us when we could kill Iranians, which they were in favor of, or about our oil. They didn't care about us when Saddam was destroying our country and our society. Quite frankly, I think there's an element of truth of that, and we've got to come to terms with it. I think we did a tremendous good in ridding the world of Saddam and his sons. It was an evil regime that makes the heart of darkness an inadequate metaphor for it. as we calculate the cost ourselves and not the benefits for the Iraqis, and let me say, I think that's a wrong calculation, although I understand why we do it. Certainly, as the number of casualties has grown up, as Iraq has become, and I think it has, an attractive area for jihadists and to mobilize against the United States, we have to recognize that cost is going up too. So it's not an easy question, and it's a very important question to come to terms with.
There are quite a number of questions about other countries in the region, and some of them relate to what happened to these weapons of mass destruction if they really did exist. Can you comment at all on whether you believe or whether there's any evidence that some of these weapons went to Syria or Lebanon? And there are a number of questions whether you think that some of the Iraqi weapons are now in the hands of terrorists.
Well, you have to separate two kinds of weapons. The Iraqis, we all know, produce large numbers of chemical and a smaller number, but still large number of biological weapons in the 1980s in conjunction with the Iran-Iraq War. Now, they were supposed to destroy them. They were supposed to let the UN destroy them. They destroyed a number of themselves. Did some of them survive? Absolutely. In fact, I think about a dozen of them have now been discovered in Iraq in onesies and twosies. The end of a war is never nice. They ended two wars. Did some get lost in the process? Were some hidden? Absolutely. But the real meaningful question relates to how about the weapons that we thought were there? Did they go someplace else, and is that the reason we're not finding them? I'll tell you how I approached the issue. They could have gone to Syria, or they could have gone to Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera. There are photographs of trucks going to Syria before the war, but the Syrian government was not willing to allow the Iraqi survey group to go traipsing through Syria, and they were saying there's nothing there. So that was, to go to the source, which is what you'd like to do, you couldn't do. So we did the next thing. If weapons had gone to Syria, they had to be produced. If weapons were produced, they required at least three things: a productive enterprise, scientists and engineers to work on it, security people to guard and move them. And so if we go out and we try to find those, and we used every technique, legal technique that was available to us. It was probably the only time in my life I'll have it, a $10 million revolving fund and a stack of green cards. You come tell me where the weapons are, where they were produced, your involvement in it, and you can move to San Francisco, and we'll set you up for life. Now, one of the stories I quickly discovered in Iraq, a lot of people would fabricate, and so you had to be careful. I have a stack of offers to sell me red mercury, which, if any of you know what red mercury is, it doesn't exist. And they wanted to move very large villages that were all part of their immediate family. But they didn't exist. They didn't come forward. We searched the country for the large productive enterprise that would have been required. They didn't come, couldn't find it, didn't exist as far as I'm concerned. So we look for that. So my conclusion is large weapon stockpiles didn't exist. So ipso facto, they didn't move to Syria or Lebanon. And that's the best you're going to do. There will always be, and we're going to have to learn to live with it, unresolved ambiguity. We let looting take place from the 9th of April until the end of May. I first went to Iraq in May. The U.S. military did not begin street patrols in Baghdad until the last week in May. Place was torn apart. Will we ever be able to put that Humpty Dumpty back together again and say with 100% certainty, this didn't exist, this didn't move? No. We're going to have to live with it. I would say at my confidence level of 85%, it didn't exist, so therefore it didn't move.
There are a few questions about the future with respect to the Middle East and nuclear weapons and Israel's posture in that region. Do you believe that the Middle East nuclear proliferation situation could be ameliorated if the Israelis committed to a nuclear-free region?
I think in one sense, I think yes, if the precondition occurred. I do not think the Israelis will commit themselves more than just a verbal commitment to it, absent a permanent lasting peace settlement. If you had a permanent lasting peace settlement, here again is what I sometimes get disturbed of people mixing up tactics and root causes. The nuclear weapons of Israel exist and were created because of the security situation Israel thought it lived in. They then therefore later become a source of tension and of other states seeking weapons of mass destruction. But the Israelis will never voluntarily eliminate their weapons of mass destruction, their nuclear program, until there is a peace adjustment. If you got that peace adjustment, I in fact think a nuclear freeze and nuclear elimination program would be possible, and in fact almost certainly would be helpful. But I think to hang out the belief that if only Israel today would give up its nuclear weapons, everything would be hunky-dory, we'd all be seeing kumbaya in the Middle East, is totally unrealistic and doesn't recognize the fundamental security dilemmas. We really need to look at root causes and deal with root causes.
Do you have a personal theory on why it was that that so many seemingly knowledgeable people thought and so many intelligence agencies thought that Iraq possessed these weapons? Was there something going on in Iraq, something the way they behaved or they postured themselves, that many people, also including Mr. Chalabi, thought that they had these weapons? What is your theory about that, and what does it tell us about the future in thinking about states that might have nuclear weapons?
I think that's an excellent question. It really goes to some fundamental issues. One of the most frequent questions asked is, well, if Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction, why did he act like he had weapons of mass destruction? Why was he willing to lose his regime? It's a very American sort of question if you actually think about it. Saddam, as most totalitarian dictators, at the very end, become most fearful of their own people. And Saddam had reasons to be fearful of his own people. The Kurds and the Shias hated him. They had tried to overthrow him and had suffered tremendously for it. He was afraid of another uprising. Now, he had dealt certainly decisively with the Kurds with the use of chemical weapons in 88 at Halabja. Horrible. And he believed that the knowledge and belief he had those weapons was what actually kept the Kurds in check. And actually, if you talk to the Kurds had a tremendous respect for the weapons of mass destruction they thought Saddam had. The second group he feared most, and for good reasons, true of almost every totalitarian dictator, the military, the guys with guns. Saddam thought that if, in fact, he indicated he had complied with the UN and he had given up those weapons, that would be a sign of weakness and he'd be subject to a successful military coup. The third thing that impacted on him is Saddam never gave up his intention of eventually acquiring military weapons. Now, he concocted in his mind, I mean, the best series of interrogation questions we have of Tariq Aziz, the vice president of Iraq, is that Saddam concocted the view in 2000 that as long as you didn't put a weapon of mass destruction on the end of a missile, he could build missiles of whatever range. It was only when they were actually mated with a warhead. He didn't give up his desire, so he continued to act like it. So that made it a target where the belief was credible. The second fact is we had no human operatives of our own in Iraq after 1998. So we were vulnerable to people describing programs that turned out not to exist. The third reason is the one thing that kept our Iraq policy together, and this is across administrations, is as true of the Clinton administration as it is of the Bush administration. The one thing that kept our policy together and kept allies supporting us during this period was the belief that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So there was a very high bar of disproof. If you believed he didn't have those weapons, you had to realize, A, first of all, if you were right, you were threatening fundamental American policy, the very glue that made Iraq policy stand together with allies. And you had to prove this negative, which is almost always in the intelligence world, an impossible thing to improve. So it was literally the perfect storm that created the possibility to get it wrong. And do we have to worry about it in other circumstances with other proliferators? Absolutely, we do.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. There are several questioners of a more personal nature about you. I'd like to sort of pack a couple of them together.
I'm handsome, married, what else?
This goes without saying. Following, were you unfairly portrayed as being too loyal to President George W. Bush? Were you unfairly portrayed as deflecting blame from the White House to the CIA? And would you like to tell a national radio audience whether you plan to vote for Bush or Kerry?
I don't, do I think I was unfairly portrayed? Actually, you know, you're always in difficulty when you ask people how they portray, you're portrayed or if you're unfairly, because you don't, yourself, you don't really know how you're portrayed. I'll answer the question by what I feel. I think the intelligence community did a disservice to both President Clinton and President Bush. And it's not just the American intelligence service. Let me tell you, I've had the honor, I'm not sure what the appropriate adjective is, of reading the intelligence reports of a large number of our allies and other states. Every one of them believed that Saddam had at least chemical and biological weapons. In fact, Monsieur Guy Lepin, the French, at the time, French foreign minister, he's now their interior minister, before the war wrote a lead article on the front page of Le Monde, which says, Saddam certainly has chemical and biological weapons. Now, he didn't agree with American policy, but he had no doubt that those weapons existed. I think it was a failure of the intelligence system, and unless you deal with that failure, you're going to be surprised again, and you may not be so lucky as this time.
Our thanks to Dr. David Kaye, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector, for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 101st year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. I was surprised.